Hi, Alexi.
Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
I'm doing good.
Good. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright of Blogging Heads TV, and this is an episode of Worldwise. You are Alexi Sidorenko, a Russian blogger. You actually live, you spend a lot of time in Poland as well, but right now you're in Moscow, and you've graciously agreed to fill us in on things happening in Moscow. And a lot of things are, I mean, one of which Americans are certainly quite familiar with, that is that Edward Snowden, so far as we know, remains at the Moscow airport, or at least a hotel kind of appended to the Moscow airport.
Yeah, there are rumors that he's still there. I was leaving Moscow a month ago when he just arrived. But of course, there were conspiracy theories that he's already on some KGB dacha, you know, like, and he's being either tortured or being accepted as an important guest. But I mean, like, anyway, it was kind of a historic, you know, like, to feel, you know, like, oh, I'm departing from the same airport where probably is Edward Snowden is being capped. Well, or let's see, or the official sources say so.
That is a brush with greatness. Did you find yourself looking at people as they went by to see if any of them looked like they might be Edward Snowden in disguise or anything? No.
I haven't, but I was actually thinking of going to this capsule hotel that is situated in Terminal D and, you know, like, trying to find out whether there are guards or whether, you know, any evidence of presence of Edward Snowden.
I heard somewhere that there was a whole floor of the hotel blocked off by security, which is kind of a clue if the report is accurate. But as for the KGB, I think a lot of people are speculating that one way or another they have gotten a hold of his hard drive, but who knows what the truth is. But what do people think about this in Moscow? I assume the story has gotten a lot of attention.
Oh yes, there is a lot of attention, and there is a lot of anti-Americanism on the rise. On one hand, on the other hand, KGB had been and the FSB had been overhearing Russians and Soviet citizens conversations for quite so long. So I mean, like, there is overall, let's say, lack of trust towards any means of communication. I mean, like, there are still you know, sayings, you know, like, that this is not a topic for the conversation over phone, which
comes... we say that more and more in America as well, increasingly, but
yeah, well, yeah, so I mean, like, and in general there was this feeling that, you know, like, sooner or later, I mean, like, virtually, I mean, like, since the information is stored somewhere, so someone has an access to it. And I mean, like, in Russia, with its overall lack of trust towards law, there was always thinking that, you know, like, whatever the law offers or promises, like, there will always be some governmental bodies that would like to override the law.
So I guess, I mean, on the one hand, what Edward Snowden is saying the American government does probably doesn't strike Russians as highly irregular, right? I mean, it's the kind of thing that they have just assumed their government does, right?
Yeah.
So it's not, it can't be considered, you know, a really atrocious crime. But on the other hand, you said there's certain a certain amount of anti-Americanism. So I guess regardless of what they think of, you know, what Edward Snowden has done and how dramatic the revelations are or not, are you saying they kind of most Russians like the idea of kind of sticking it to the Americans here and granting him asylum?
Well, some of them obviously do. I mean, like, just, you know, because this kind of a affair with Snowden, you know, like, and that Putin, you know, like, gets a phone call from Obama, and this is like a really like high issue, and Putin doesn't give away Snowden, and I mean, like, this kind of a, for the conservative part of the society, this kind of a confirms this myth of great Putin, you know, like being an equal to the United States, and, you know, like being able to reject pressure and not giving away Snowden. And on the other hand, it also creates this kind of a myth that, oh, Russia is the real defender of the human rights. Will, mm-hmm. Yeah, on the and well, I mean, like, those people obviously do not say that Putin's government and Putin's secret services are spying on Russian citizens much more than the United States government, right, allegedly collects information on its own and foreign citizens.
Okay, so let me ask the question this way. Would it be bad for Putin politically to turn Snowden over to the U.S. or to do anything that led to him winding up in the U.S., just, you know, not granting him asylum in a way that led to him ultimately winding up in U.S. hands? Would anything like that be perceived as a kind of surrender or submission to the U.S. in a way that would be politically bad for Putin?
I mean, politically, not really. I mean, like, Snowden is, I would say that for Putin, Snowden is rather a toy or a source of interesting information. I mean, like, and the ability, you know, like, and the new card in his card pack, you know, like, that he can play with. I don't mm-hmm. think that, and I think that Snowden will be played very practically. Whatever, like, I mean, right now they know allegedly the price of Snowden and whatever secrets he has. So right now the dynamics of the situation, what could be seen was that they were just negotiating, you know, like how to sell Snowden better. Because I don't think that there will be political consequences, and definitely in Russia, it's not the kind of a high-level domestic issue. It's just a happy coincidence for Putin that Snowden landed in Sheremetyevo Airport.
Mm-hmm. So you think it's still possible that they could turn him over to the Americans?
Well, I think as soon as they get all the information, then they realize that there is nothing more either to blackmail or extract from Snowden. Either to blackmail the United States with or extract from Snowden. I think they you know, like, there will be no problem, you know, of giving him up. In this very, very practical, real politic way. But obviously, I mean, like, if the price is high, but because also there could be a situation when they would like, you know, like in this Soviet tradition, Soviet Cold War traditions, you know, like, to have this guy on our side. I mean, like, Snowden, I guess, is also not this kind of a communist dissident type of person, and it's not 1950s anymore. So mm-hmm. I think that I mean, like, with all his situation, it would be hard to be a defender of the Putin's regime.
Okay, and this anti-Americanism, does this largely just go back to the Cold War, or are there things that either America does or maybe Putin does to keep it alive?
Oh, yeah. I mean, whatever the TV channel you can look at, and especially, like, lots of stuff about foreign agents, and especially all these new waves of propaganda that, for example, post-election protests were inspired by foreign governments, American in particular, the the foreign agents law about NGOs. I mean, this has a lot of not just anti-American context, but anti-Western context in general. And this is always, not always, but especially after the post-election protests, this kind of anti-Western, let's say, anti-Western notions, anti-Western atmosphere is kept... kept active, and it's being reaffirmed and reconfirmed with every news. I mean, like, almost every day there are some news and there are some conclusions drawn from the events, or like that would have this idea, or again, you know, like there was, you know, like this evil West, you know, like trying to.
So, are you saying the protests that we've heard about? In Moscow over the last, you know, year or two, which are a really interesting phenomenon that we're going to talk about more, but because the Russian government sees them as a threat, it gives the Russian government more of an incentive to demonize the whole kind of Western political culture with which the protests are identified?
Oh, yeah. This is correct.
And it still the government still controls enough of the media that it can... that it can very effectively demonize.
Oh, yes. This is very correct.
Uh-huh.
And especially, I mean, they see all these events, for example, especially in Syria and the Arab Spring being interpreted solely as the Western, let's say, Western prepared rebellion. And I mean, obviously, we know that the situation is much, much more difficult and complex, and but still, in the Russian media, mm-hmm. in the state-controlled media, it's being presented as solely as some kind of a revolution in the puppet regime.
And what is the popular view of the situation in Syria, or the popular views? I mean, I know Russia has strategic interests in Syria. They have a port in Syria that's very – a naval base in Syria that's very important to them. But how are the people pretty much siding with the government on this, or does it differ in the kinds of people you're talking about? So, like, for example, the protesters – the more liberal protesters versus other Russians, or what? How is the Syria thing viewed in Russia?
Well, the Syria thing is obviously presented as the possible scenario for Russia, and this is like a horror movie or horror story that is being told when any talk of the protests appears. I mean, like, for example, when you speak to a conservative person and you speak, you know, like, well, there is, you know, bad government, we should do something about it. So the very quick reply would be, oh, you want to do this like they do in Syria? Do you want a civil war? And I mean, like, the whole idea that the mm-hmm. that the protest, like civic protest or more democratization, leads immediately to the civil war. I mean, like, this is a very simple thing to say, but at the same time very dangerous, because it radicalizes and polarizes both parties, like those who want changes, those who don't, uh-huh. and it actually leaves no civilized ways of actually solving quite important problems. I mean, like with the accountability and transparency of governance, for example, or like transparent and non-violated elections.
Mm-hmm. So it all kind of ties together, the narrative. I mean, the government is saying that, okay, in Syria, those protests are actually Western-supported protests, and in Moscow, the protests are actually Western-supported protests, and Syria shows that your country will fall apart if the Western-supported protesters have their way. Right.
Yes. And in general, and on the top of this, the Snowden case, and because, you know, like you get the complete, you know, like evil empire vision, because, you know, like not only just you have revolutions all over the world, but also you have after that these huge data bank that collects and records all your phone calls and metadata to to those phone calls. So, like, I mean, like if I wouldn't have more information situation, I would be completely, you know, like frightened and angry, and, you know, like I would totally probably believe Putin. But I mean, like, obviously this is not the way it is, but I mean, like, the vision and the image is quite frightening. I mean, like Hunger Games, imagine, you know, like that you are in whatever zone 15 at the end of all of it. Like,
and I guess on the Snowden thing, I mean, it really matters that part of the deal here is the U.S. government wasn't just listening to its own citizens' phone calls, as the Russian government does, but apparently was listening to the phone, or, you know, had access to phone calls, emails involving a lot of foreigners.
Yeah, and especially through these, what the Spiegel, at least, if we can trust Spiegel, if there was this network of exchanges between like German secret services and whatever, that, and they would provide, you know, information on each other, citizens. That, so I mean, like this creates lots of.
Okay, and I was actually a little incorrect there when I mean. It's not so much listening to phone calls as having access to the data about all the phone calls that have been made. Now, when it comes to emails, I think it is more a question of actually prying into the content as far as what the U.S. government's been doing. Yeah. Anyway, so on the subject of protests, this Russian Alexei Navalny has gotten a lot of attention. He has been an anti-corruption protester. He was also, I guess, he's running for mayor of Moscow. He was tried on charges that a lot of people thought were trumped up, corruption charges, found guilty. But then recently, and I guess kind of surprisingly, released, which, although the conviction wasn't overturned, I think the release will actually allow him to run for mayor of Moscow. Is all of that right?
Well, I mean, like, he's still convicted for 5 years. It's just this strange action that happened after, well, not after, right after his conviction, that he was released for some temporary for some time. I mean, like, he still has to face the charges, not just the charges, but the verdict. Or if he would try to appeal, I mean, like, there are still like very high doubts that he would be able to completely, you know, like, leave the courtroom without these 5 years of imprisonment or penal colony, to be precise.
There were protests after his conviction by his supporters, and I think pretty substantial protests. Is one suspicion that the government released him in response to the protests to calm things down, or not?
Well, I mean, like, most, because right now the, like, Russians love conspiracy theories. Some optimists say yes, this is the way it worked. I mean, like, they got him into prison. They saw that, like, several thousand people, not only in Moscow, not even just in Russia. I mean, like, all over the world, there were some. I mean, like, in front of the embassies, there were some demonstrations, but in Moscow, there were several thousands. So the optimists say that yes, like, the civil society and the opposition had shown its force to the government, therefore they released him. The more popular conspiracy theory says that, well, actually, it was planned in advance, and I mean, like, Navalny is just being used in order to participate in the Moscow mayor's elections, and he will probably lose. And as soon as he loses, then, you know, he would be imprisoned, and his political reputation will be destroyed. So it's kind of a Byzantine game in order to not just make him a martyr, because if he would go to jail right now, he would be a martyr, but in order to destroy his reputation, to prove that he doesn't have actual enough support, and then, you know, to then imprison him not as a martyr, but as a loser.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, But I gather that what he represents, which is protests about corruption and also, I guess, protests about the concentration of power in Putin's hands, is that one of his themes, or at least one of the protesters' themes broadly?
Lawlessness, illegal migration, and actually migration control, what he is especially...
Those are his things, as well as corruption?
Yeah.
Now, that raises a question. I mean, he is going to be naturally thought of by Americans who think of themselves as pro-democracy and so on, and pro-human rights. Reading the stories about him, they're going to think of him as one of ours and the hero, but I gather that his following... The people who follow him probably would not entirely meet with the approval of the average American, say, liberal or something, right? I mean, am I right about that? I mean,
in the American spectrum, I believe he's more like a, let's say, conservative, like he's a rightist. Obviously, when it comes to migration control. But in a way, I'm like, he's conservative also in the things that, you know, like in this conservative democratic way that he like, for example, he's definitely not liberal in the sense of, in the American spectrum, I believe.
Right. But beyond just being not liberal in the American sense, is there something that Americans would find kind of scary about him? You know, I mean, appealing to, I don't know, dark nationalist xenophobic impulses or anything?
Well, I mean, the nationalism is probably the most, let's say, his weak point in his international reputation. He has been known for a number of quite, let's say, aggressive views. Just yesterday, there was a scandal about his post on the blog about Georgians during the Georgian War. And he had written, like, first of all, he addressed them in a not very nice way. But at the same time, he proposed quite, you know, like, quite decisive, to put it mildly, measures. What Russia should undertake in order...
What's an example of one of the decisive measures?
Well, he would propose that they would send a rocket to their to the Georgian headquarters, and then he would write that, oh, actually, we shouldn't do this because this is exactly what Georgians want. So it was kind of a not a very passive...
So he's talking about an attack, a military attack?
Well, I mean, like, it was during the Russian-Georgian War.
I see.
And I mean, like, and if you remember the situation well, the original kind of a perception was that Georgia attacked Russia.
Right.
Like, not Russia, but South Ossetia.
Right.
And, of course, we know the results of the European Commission report that, I mean, like, it was a provocation and it was prepared provocation. But, I mean, like, back then, you know, like, there was no European Commission report, and the overall view, even among the liberals and the pro-democratic, not just Putinists, was that it was kind of it was an attack. And, of course, that was kind of a strange to see a lot of people whom you would think they would be kind of resistant to this kind of a war war propaganda, war feeling. They would, but I mean, like, lots of people would write back then a lot of very angry posts and like really not very pacifist posts. So yeah, back then Navalny couldn't probably limit himself in his speech, but what for me, for example, was not quite good with that yesterday, when it, you know, like, several years after the war, and it was, you know, like, big Russia, small Georgia, you know, like, he still say that it, except that I would call Georgians differently, and he said that he apologizes for calling them not a very in a very nice way, you know, like, I would sign my words under every word that I've written. back then. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, like, if you want, I can go back to this.
That's okay. I think we get the sense of it. So I guess the divide, I mean, the Russian government still controls conventional television broadcasts pretty thoroughly, right? And I gather, to some extent, a difference between these protesters, which the government considers, you know, corrupted by Western influence or something, and the people who oppose the protesters, one thing about the they have access to different media, right? I mean, the protesters are more likely to be online, to have internet access, and to make extensive use of it, right? So they're, to some extent, they're just plugged into different media channels from many of the people who oppose them, who are more dependent on the government-controlled media avenues. Is that right?
Once again, because I guess I kind of realized what you're asking about, but I lost your last
okay.
point.
Okay, well, I think you've said before, the government still controls conventional, regular television, TV
not,
set
not
in
just,
your living room.
Not just conventional. I mean, like, since we last spoke, I mean, the Kremlin has been so masterful in controlling all kinds of media. I mean, like, it's really interesting to see how this particular authoritarian regime, you know, like, actually manages to, you know, like, infiltrate blogger networks, co-opt important and influential media portals, or, for example, pressure on the businessmen who were helping out independent media portals. I mean, like, a lot of newspapers or online portals have been closed. Whereas more and more paid bloggers or the networks of pro-government bloggers had appeared.
So the government has gotten better at influencing or even controlling the information that passes over the internet.
Yeah, yeah, and especially when it comes to the first interpretation moment. I mean, like, when something happens and you have to have, you know, like, the first interpretation, you know, like, yeah, the Kremlin, you know, does its best. I mean, like, but sometimes they still use these kind of old school shutdown methods. For example, mm-hmm. During these events after Navalny's verdict, they simply turned off live journals would say, like, oops, sorry, we have some problems, so we're closing down. So
what is Live Journal? Is that an independent outlet?
No, it's not an independent outlet, but it was kind of the main for many years, starting 2005 till, I guess, 2011. It was kind of the main discussion platform in Russia. And right now, you know, like, people would just go to Facebook or Twitter.
Mm-hmm. And that is, I mean, the protest movement is dependent, I gather, on channels of communication that the government doesn't control, right? And there still are those.
Yeah.
I mean, is your sense that the government is getting so good at influencing internet communication that the protest movement is going to subside or even die, or do you think that on balance?
I think it's just the point is that it's really competition, and so mm-hmm. far, well, obviously, I mean, for example, the urges of the government to block entire resources like Twitter or Facebook that happens from time to time, it just shows that it might be actually losing or maybe right. not controlling well enough, but. I mean, obviously, the good thing is that you can't, you know, like, simply, you know, block Facebook, you know, because then it will be, you know, problematic. But I think that over and over the government tries to do this. For example, it was very interesting to observe the overall case with ВКонтакте network. which they actually forced to force the creator of the network. It looks like a Facebook clone. It has about 40 million users all over the world, and it's quite influential. And they actually forced the creator of this network to sell its share recently, just a few months ago. And it was some strange situation when he was first accused of running over a policeman. He had to fled Russia, and then at the same time, it was said that he is selling his share to the Kremlin-owned startup venture foundation.
Hmm.
And right now it's sold, and as soon as it was sold, the charges were lifted. So,
and now what is the Kremlin going to do? Are they going to shut it down or just start monitoring it or what?
Well, I think that, I wouldn't speculate on this, but obviously, as long as they have it under control, they have more control.
Mm-hmm. And what about Facebook itself? Are there more and more Russians who use Facebook and Twitter?
Yes, I believe so. It's still, there are more of Kontakte users compared to Facebook. But for example, if you take a look at the, oppositionists or protest movement, they are mostly on Facebook and on Twitter.
Okay. So we'll see which forces carry the day there, I guess. I wanted to ask you quickly about the issue of gay rights in Russia, which has gotten attention in America. I gather that there's been legislation to do things like not just block the adoption of Russian children to gay couples, but to block the adoption of Russian children in countries where gay marriage is legal and things like that. What's the deal on gay rights there?
Well, I haven't been, following this topic closely, but I've been mostly mostly focused on this ban of gay propaganda law that considers every, for example, public coming out as a gay propaganda.
So it would make it illegal to say that you are a homosexual?
Well, practically, publicly? Yes. Well, at least as I understand the law, or, yeah. Publish pictures of, people hanging each other's hands, or doing this publicly on the street.
And has that law passed, or it's just proposed?
It was definitely passed in St. Petersburg, but I guess...
It's a municipal law?
No, but it was later, it passed definitely for the lower chamber of the parliament. I'm not sure if it was signed. Let me just check for a second.
But there's no, there isn't sufficient opposition.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's been signed into law as a national law?
Right now it's a national law. Putin signed it on the 30th. Of June, so 23 days ago. Yeah.
Okay. Wow. And so there just isn't enough publicly expressed opposition to laws like that as to really get in the way.
What do you mean?
I mean, there just there's not much. Were there big protests against the passage of that law? Is there any big movement in Russia against those kinds of laws?
Big movement? No, because I'm not a big viewer of this whole situation, but so far people, like the majority, the heterosexuals, they do not seem to support much homosexuals. There is no such feeling that this is a human rights issue, and I believe that this still represents a problem for the Russian society, because there are some online communities that heterosexuals for homosexuals, but the overall public communities of homosexuals, they are not quite numerous.
Mm-hmm.
So they probably won't be able to, stand for. They definitely make demonstration, but they are not numerous.
Mm-hmm.
And,
okay.
Yeah, and sometimes, as long as it goes, sometimes it just looks this, it attracts even more irritation in the, let's say, non-informed majority. Mm-hmm. They see like, oh, again, like, look at them. And it's not being, you know, like, viewed as, you know, like people, you know, standing for their human rights.
And presumably a big gay rights movement would be demonized by politicians, maybe by the Kremlin, as, among other things, a kind of a Western
inspired or supported thing. Was just today's news that there was some leaked FSB analytical note, a memo, that said that drag addicts and homosexuals are politically untrusted categories of people because it's been noted that there are many of them joining political protests.
So it all ties together.
So it really reminds us some European countries in the 30s, you know, with all the consequences.
You mean in the sense of demonizing all forms of criticism of the government as being you know, foreign in origin and needing to be suppressed? You mean that?
Well, yes. It's just I think that, you know, like some ultra conservative conservatism with the overall kind of a isolationism. Yeah, I would mm-hmm. call this.
Mm-hmm. And I guess that was kind of what I was getting at. I mean, is Navalny, is he part of that, or at least in that vicinity?
Well, no. I mean, like, Navalny never said anything clearly anti-gay. Mm-hmm. At least as far as I know.
Uh-huh.
So he doesn't use this thing, and he says that, like, well, this is not a problem.
Okay.
So,
all right.
I'm more than sure that he wouldn't be the one who would, you know, like, put on an agenda, you know, like, same-sex marriages. Mm-hmm. He clearly represents him. Like, he has a very beautiful wife, and they have two daughters. So he represents very typical, you know, like, kind of a. Very typical role model of, you know, like, mm-hmm. regular lifestyle and family.
Well, this has been very illuminating. Is there anything you want to say in closing? I mean, it's a very interesting time in Russia. I mean, you have a certain amount of ferment and criticism of the government that has to some extent been facilitated by the new communications media, the internet, but the government is striking back and exerting as much control as it can, and it sounds like there's a lot of flux there. Do you have any sense for where things are heading, or whether you know, what side will prevail in the end, if either, or what?
Well, I'm an optimist. You know, like, I believe that the good will prevail.
I hope you're right.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I'm not sure that it happens during my lifetime.
Well, okay, then I'm not sure how optimistic that is. How old are you?
I'm 29.
Okay. Well, that's not highly, highly optimistic, I would
well,
say.
Yeah.
Unless you're pessimistic about your lifespan, in which case that would be optimistic, but I doubt you are. Well, listen, thank you so much, Alexei. I'll hope to check back in with you down the road.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you as
well. Okay. Take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.